Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulippe. This week we'll hear about the final days of the Frameline 39 LGBT Film Festival. We'll hear the XYZ of it from artistic director Frances Wallace. She'll be joined by filmmaker Jack Walsh. We'll also hear about the musicals in this summer's Transcendence Theater Productions at Jack London State Park. Also, a visit with dramatic soprano Nina Stemma, who sings Leonore in the San Francisco Symphony performances of Beethoven's Fidelio. Plus, Peter Robbins will be by with his summer reading list. Stay with us. Given for a reason to start today's shoe. The music and theme will be familiar to anyone who's seen any of the dozens of screenings at the venues in San Francisco and the East Bay, as the theme of Frameline 39, the 39th San Francisco International LGBTQ Film Festival, is There's No Place Like Here, and in what will no doubt go down in Frameline history as one of the most memorable trailers that begins each screening, drag queen Peaches Christ and company reimagine Dorothy's twister-propelled journey, with Oz being San Francisco. Including today's 12 separate screenings, there are just 4 days left of the 10-day festival, a good time to look back on what's happened and to look forward to what's to come. And so I invited Frances Wallace back to join me to talk about all things Frameline. Native Aussie Frances Wallace has over a decade of experience working with Frameline, rising through the ranks to her current title of executive director. She also recently worked as Frameline's East Coast representative, attending conferences and developing strategic partnerships with both nonprofit media and corporate groups within the New York City area. Frances, so pleased you could take some time to join us again.
Thanks
today.
So much, David. It's a delight to be here.
She's joined by Jack Walsh, a producer of Feelings Are Facts, The Life of Yvonne Rainer, which is having its Bay Area premiere. Jack's producer and filmmaker that screens this Saturday morning at 11 at the Castro Theater. Jack, welcome to you.
Thank you, David. Wonderful to be here.
Well, Frances, we got to talk about that infamous trailer, some of which has been making the rounds every screening. What's the reaction been to that trailer?
Oh, just extraordinary. The audience is saying that they, you know, it's the best trailer yet. The response has just been overwhelming, actually, and really just great thanks to Peaches Christ and Brian Benson too. We initially chatted to Peaches back, you know, about 6 months ago. And she was like, oh, I've got a concept. But once we saw it in production and then saw the results, we were just blown away. So it's become very iconic very quickly.
Very nice. Now, the festival opened with a fairly controversial film which starred James Franco and Zachary Quinto, I Am Michael, which I talked about last week with Frameline's Peter Stein. Now that it's been screened, what's been the reaction to it?
Actually, the mostly positive, I would say about 80% of the audience kind of really loved the film, really embraced it. It was quite a polarizing film too. I'd say about 20% of the audience did not enjoy it. They had kind of problems with the content, but it was our intent, actually, to set up a conversation. We wanted this to be a festival that was a conversation starter and provocative, and that's how we set it up with I Am Michael.
For those that aren't familiar with it, just a brief recap of what the story is.
Yeah, it's the background of Michael Glatz, actually, who was, huge in the Bay Area in terms of queer media, and then had kind of a life crisis in his early 30s, kind of a sickness, bit of a scare, and basically went back into religion. So it's a conversion story. And it basically ends on that note. So, yeah, quite a controversial story for an LGBTQ film festival to open with.
I went in, I saw the screening, and I went in pessimistically, but I really appreciated the way the subject was treated, and it wasn't by any means polarizing, I think.
No, the audience has had mixed reaction, but they're still talking about it. So that's a week later, and that was our intention.
I have to say, I was also quite moved at your opening speech to the whole beginning of the festival, where you choked up talking about how wonderful your staff is.
I was trying not to. Yeah, I know. That was quite surprising to me, actually, too. But it's just, yeah, I mean, I'm the executive director, but, you know, it takes a whole gay village, I often say. So there's, you know, there's like 20 of us, 40 of us in the biggest scheme of things, an extraordinary team of people
and
pull this off.
Over 400 volunteers,
400
which we hear about.
400 volunteers,
amazing.
Yeah, extraordinary. Mm.
Now, how many of the 180 or so offerings for this festival will you have seen either as a pre-screener or in the theater?
Mm. Myself, probably around 60% of those films I have. There's three chief programmers, myself included. So we tend to divvy it up, you know, with over 700 submissions and all of the festivals, like national and international. So we all don't get to see everything, but we tend to divvy it up.
And I imagine an equal amount has found its way to the cutting room floor, so to speak, that didn't quite make this festival its way into another.
Yeah, exactly. It's highly competitive, and we appreciate that. We appreciate all of the submissions. We make sure we watch absolutely everything. We have multiple meetings, discussions. It's, you know, that process goes on for about 6 to 8 months. So basically, once we're done in July, we just start again.
Mm. I think by the end of the Sunday screenings, I'll be up to about 15, which is the most I've ever seen.
Fantastic, David. Fantastic.
Really diving all in on this.
Excellent.
Any surprises along the way? More than midway through?
I would say, personally, one of the highlights was the Tab Hunter Confidential with the Frameline Award going to Jeffrey Schwartz. But the reaction to Tab Hunter's arrival at the theatre and the audience response was just one of those kind of really high point experiences. And yeah, the media, the paparazzi, it was, you know, it was like a Hollywood screening. And he is just gracious and divine and funny and down to earth. It was a beautiful event.
And I finally caught the rest of the documentary through a screen because I had to leave midway through that. And I told Peter last week that I talked with Tab here in studio back in 2005 or so when he had his big autobiography coming out. And still, he's thriving. He looks great. 80-something.
Yeah, he's 84. You know, he looks 60-something, if that. Yeah, and he's got all this energy. He chatted to everyone, had his photo taken with everyone. You know, he's an incredible inspiration to us all, actually. Yeah.
Well, since we're on the subject of documentaries, there's also one on, there was one on Rainer Fassbender, porn mogul Chuck Holmes, one of which, we just talked about Tab Hunter, the recipient of the Frameline Award with Jeffrey Schwartz, which brings us to today's guest, Jack Walsh. Jack has been involved with several Frameline festivals, and LGBT films include 2005 Screaming Queens, The Riot at Compton's Cafeteria, a documentary for which he was producer, 2002's Hope Along the Wind, The Life of Harry Hay, for which he also was producer, and then he was also director and writer for 1995's The Second Coming, which has an interesting double entendre title. We could talk about that, perhaps. And in 1993, he was also cinematographer, director, and writer for Deer Rock. So welcome once again, Jack.
Oh, thank you.
You're also a consultant for the Celluloid Closet, I see, back in 1995.
Yeah, that's a bit of a misnomer, but it's an IMDb kind of thing. But yeah, I was picked up on a credit list. So,
okay.
But I'm a member of the board of Reflective Image who produced that documentary.
Well, tell us how you came across this woman, Yvonne Rayner, for a documentary subject.
Sure. Yvonne actually grew up here. She was raised in the Sunset, and she went to Lowell High School. And in the 50s, you know, San Francisco was a very different place. But one of the interesting things about Yvonne is that her parents were anarchist. So she came from a very unusual family for the Bay Area. And I met Yvonne in the late 80s in New York when I was running a media arts center called the Collective for Living Cinema in Lower Manhattan. And she was the president of the board of directors. So I knew Yvonne pretty well as a filmmaker. She had a stellar career as a filmmaker, did 7 feature films, received a MacArthur Genius Grant. And in the last time, the last film she made, Murder and Murder, was also the story of her coming out and her experience with breast cancer. So I knew her film background, but I had no idea of her dance background. I knew she was a member of this well-known group called Judson Dance Theater, but I didn't know what that all meant. And then in 2006, her memoir came out by the same title, Feelings Are Facts. And I was fascinated in reading it, and the things that captured my imagination, one was that she never took a dance class until she was 25. And then at the age of 28, she and the other dancers at Judson Dance Theater revolutionized dance by introducing everyday actions like walking and running, of the first to wear street clothes and sneakers in the proscenium, and to really rip dance apart and become the grandparents, along with Anna Halpern here, of postmodern dance. So there, it was a very rich history. And then I was very attracted to the idea of an artist who doesn't find who she is so late in life, because especially in dance, people are started, you know, 3, 4, 5, and they go on to careers, and then their careers can be over by 30. So that she did that fascinated me. And then the final piece that was very interesting to me was that she was brought back to dance by Baryshnikov in around 2000. She and the Judson dancers were approached by Baryshnikov to revive their works, and it created a whole new interest in all these dancers who we've interviewed. Many of them in the film are wonderful people, some of who have major careers like Lucinda Childs or Steve Paxton, and others who didn't quite break out but just are such wonderful human beings to see and spend time with.
The challenge, of course, must have been documenting her, the dance, again, to end up on the cutting room floor. There must have been such rich material to choose from.
There was, and we were very privileged. We had support from the Warhol Foundation that later was matched years later by Frameline when we were in our completion phase with a completion grant. And what was amazing with that initial support was that we were actually able to go and record live performances, multi-camera live performances. And that was wonderful. And one, Yvonne actually danced him when she was 75 because one of her dancers didn't show up. So we were able to capture that, which we never thought we would get. And then many of the works, the original works from the 60s, don't exist as they were performed, but they exist now as recreations. So her troupe who works with her now have been taught recreations of them. So we have that in the film as well.
Mm-hmm. And there must be something in the water for these 80-somethings to be thriving. I mean, we talked about Tab Hunter, still very vital, and so is Yvonne. She's in her 80s now and still doing her thing.
Yeah, I think that there is one theory that goes people who tend to be involved in creative practice or involved with whatever they do in a level of happiness live longer lives. But there's genes that come into it as well. And as you learn in the film, actually, Yvonne is also a breast cancer survivor of over 20 years at this point.
Wow. Feelings Are Facts, The Life of Yvonne Rainer, will have its Bay Area premiere this Saturday morning at 11. And what a great venue, the Castro Theater. You must be excited about that.
Very excited to be showing it in our hometown and the Castro. My producer, Christine Murray, who's also here, will have her posse with her. And we're looking forward to a wonderful screening there.
Well, you're no stranger to the festival. Are you? Is this a great opportunity to network with other professionals in the documentary field or just in general?
In general, certainly. I mean, this festival and festivals just in general are how we make our living in a lot of ways. It's the opportunity to show work, but it's also the opportunity when we're in the middle of developing or in the middle of a production or post-production to meet with people, to make those relationships. So, for example, Frameline had a lovely filmmaker brunch the other day that was hosted by HBO that had a number of industry professionals there. And those opportunities are very rare for filmmakers to get the attention, I think, of production executives and have the opportunity to really speak one-on-one with them. So it's always a wonderful experience.
And not a bad week to be having it here during San Francisco.
Well, that's a little wild, but, you know, we'll see.
Francis, one of the most popular features of the film festival is the series of shorts that get done, always popular, and several opportunities to catch the Fun and Boys and Fun and Girls shorts, two opportunities to see them. But there's also a series called Only in San Francisco, and then Worldly Affairs, which screens tomorrow at 4. What has the reaction been to the shorts aspect of the festival?
I think the shorts are actually such a crucial part of any festival, but especially Frameline. We have one of the largest selections of shorts programs for festivals, and it's also highly competitive. The Worldly Affairs is, tomorrow is a special Latino edition too, so that'll be extraordinary. And if you miss the kind of sold-out Fun and Boy shorts and Fun and Girl shorts, you can see them again Sunday. Fun and Girl shorts is at 11 a.m. at the Castro, and Fun and Boy shorts is 1:30. At the Castro, two of the most popular screenings, short screenings.
And it being Pride Sunday, I think there's going to be Fun and Boys and Girls shorts throughout the day.
all day in the Castro, yes.
Frances, Frameline is so much more than just this 10-day festival. Mm. Can you tell us how you're getting into the schools with gay cinema? And particularly, I heard in the Reel in the Closet discussion of how Frameline can now get into the schools in terms of educating people.
Yeah, vital program Youth in Motion, which just went national this year in 2015, with actually Jeffrey Schwarz, the Frameline awardee, documentary Vito, The Life of Vito Russo. So it's been exceptional. We're now actually, we're in 41 states. We moved up a state just in the last 24 hours, 750 schools. So we work with the GSA networks. And I think it's vital outside of the festival in terms of our education and distribution programs to get LGBTQ media outside of these big urban centres and to ensure that especially, you know, teenagers are seeing this type of content and, you know, making them question and, yeah, just have a greater understanding of this media.
So your support to Frameline throughout the year helps this happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Frameline.org.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, David. Thanks for the plug.
So we're at Frameline 39. Obviously, 40 is around the corner. You must have some big plans for Frameline 40.
We do. We definitely do. There's many conversations going on at this point about what 40 will look like. So more will be revealed later on in this year, actually. So, yeah, just to keep a track at Frameline.org.
Indeed. Jack Walsh, director, producer of Feelings Are Facts, The Life of Yvonne Rainer. We will have its Bay Area premiere this Saturday morning at the Castro at 11. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, David.
And Frances, always a pleasure. I look forward to talking with you again about 40 when it comes around.
Lovely. Thanks so much, David.
Well, from the cinematic, we're going to go to the operatic here on Open Air. That's the incredible voice of soprano Nina Stemma from the final scene of Wagner's Götterdämmerung, a role she last sung for San Francisco audiences in the recent Ring cycle at San Francisco Opera. She's back in town as one of the featured soloists for this weekend's concert performances of Beethoven's Fidelio, through this Sunday, officially concluding the 2014-15 season of the San Francisco Symphony and their Beethoven Festival. In her native Sweden, Nina Stemma has been named a Swedish Royal Court singer and a member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Music, and was chosen Singer of the Year by Opernwelt magazine, won the first Opera Award in London in 2013, and received the Opera News Award in 2014. San Francisco audiences will remember her from the recent Wagner Ring cycle conducted by Donald Runicles across Grove Street. I caught up with her briefly earlier this week at Davies Symphony Hall. And a fair warning, this is a field recording. My digital recorder was on the fritz, and so this is through my iPhone. Not bad quality, but not the best.
Nina, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much.
You've been a regular at opera houses around the world and across the street at San Francisco Opera for the Wagnerian Ring cycle most recently, but these will be your first performances with the San Francisco Symphony, so welcome across Grove Street.
Yeah, it's wonderful to be here.
Phenomenal reviews of your Wagnerian triumphs as Brunhilde and Isolde. Congratulations, by the way, on your recent nomination for this year's Bach Track Opera Awards in the category of Best Female Singing Performance for your Isolde at the Royal Opera House. These Wagner roles take a lot of stamina, I'm sure, and you've written about that. So the Beethoven must be a comparable walk in the park. How do you prepare differently for these roles?
They are very, very different. Beethoven is total different kind of music, of course, with the long lines you don't find as much of, and the tessitura is either very high or quite low. It moves faster, you need more flexibility in the voice, a different kind, and it's more symphonically written also for the voice. You feel more like an instrument in a way. So for me it's quite a step to tackle this role again after having sung all the Brunhildes and the Elektras.
And for these Wagnerian roles, how do you prepare your body physically for them?
I mean, I try to, you know, move just normally and try get the chances to move in everyday life, walk a lot. I am doing a bit of yoga. So it's a lot of mental training as well. And also, I mean, just singing in itself is a training. It's a physical activity. And the more you sing consciously these roles and try to make them as easygoing as possible, the more you learn and the stronger you get.
I should mention that your 2012 Decca recording of Fidelio with the Lucerne Festival Orchestra and Claudio Abbado won the Gramophone Award for Best Opera Record.
Yeah, very honored.
When did the role of Leonore come into your repertoire?
It came actually 6 years ago, as I remember. 2009, I did a concert version with the Swedish Chamber Orchestra in Sweden. So it came fairly late into my repertoire, I must say, but that's only because I've been so busy doing other stuff, doing my Wagner.
Well, you've mentioned in print the challenges of moving into new roles as your voice matures and ages, and probably physically as well, and retiring roles that are no longer right for you. Are there roles that you're looking forward to learning and adding to your repertoire?
All the time. I mean, there's always something you could add if you would like to. I will add Kundry, and in a few years even Kundry, that's in Parsifal by Wagner again. Might not be my last Wagnerian role, because after that there's time to go into something like Ortrud in Lohengrin, for instance, in like 5-6 years. And by Strauss, we have Färberin in Die Frau ohne Schatten. And I'm also learning a new role of a new opera right now. In Gothenburg, in Sweden, we will do Notorious as an opera. It's based on the film by Alfred Hitchcock from 1946. So I will do the role of Ingrid Bergman portrays, Alicia, and I'm very excited about it.
In English?
Actually not. I know there is an English translation around and also a German one, and for some reason the composer and the librettist chose to do this in Swedish. It is difficult. It's difficult to sing in Swedish, I find. Likewise in English, of course, but yeah, even to sing in your native language, it's trickier than what one would think.
Is there a language that comes easier for you to learn? I mean, you sing in every language possible when you're on the operatic stage. Is there something that says, oh, good, I'm doing Czech this week instead of Russian?
Yeah, I wish I could say that about Czech. but Russian is a beautiful language for singing, as is Italian, of course. And I must say, German is not bad. The Wagnerian German is quite singable, and he writes the music after the language, so to say. So, and also based on the bel canto style. So I must say that Italian, Russian, and German are not bad languages. Czech has, unfortunately, a bit too many consonants, yeah. Like 5-6 consonants meeting. It's not easy.
I think they had to sell all their vowels in one of the wars.
Apparently.
May saw you in Turandot at La Scala. You'll be one of four sopranos singing the role this coming season at the Met in January, I believe. And productions in Dalhalla, closer to home, near Stockholm, this coming August. Designed to have some family time together?
Yeah, as my husband is directing for the first time. So it will be some family time there. But we have, of course, holidays before that. I'm very, very excited to do this Dalhalla Turandot production in this old open mine in the Swedish summer night when it starts to get a bit dark. So we have to start quite late at night in order to do the light projections.
I understand you have some family with you in San Francisco and you're familiar with the city now. Is there places that you enjoy going together?
Yeah, we love the whole city. There's always something to do. The museums are wonderful, just to stroll around in different parts of the city, going across the bridge, walking in the redwoods around the city. There's always something to do, and the kids love it.
Well, we look forward to hearing you in the Symphony Hall and back at the Opera House soon, I hope.
Of course, we're working on it. I'm really, really happy to be here. Thank you.
Recorded at Davies Symphony Hall, Nina Demas. And here she is singing Leonore's Abscheulicher from Act 1 of Fidelio. I follow my inner calling, waver I shall not, strength I derive from faithfulness and love. The concluding affirmation, which sums up the heroine's unwavering dedication to freeing her imprisoned husband, and from the aforementioned award-winning recording on Decca. Gartenliebe from Beethoven's Fidelio, Nina Stemma performing that aria from the Act One finale of Fidelio. Fidelio can be heard this weekend, capping out the San Francisco Symphony's Beethoven Festival and their 2014-15 season. That recording, by the way, from the award-winning Decca recording, which features Jonas Kaufmann, conductor Claudio Abbado, the Lucerne Festival Orchestra, and Mahler Chamber Orchestra. Kind of appropriate, I think, that a bit of cross-dressing concludes the Beethoven Festival on Pride Sunday. Those unfamiliar with the plot, the heroine, Leonore, disguises herself as a boy to get a job in the prison where her husband is kept. Also on Saturday evening's Beethoven Festival concert, well, that will feature Shai Wozner, who was a guest of Open Air last season, and Michael Tilson Thomas leading the orchestra in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, sfsymphony.org for full concert details. And a reminder that there you can also find information about the summer and the symphony concerts, and the symphony will be featured at Sterngrove on Sunday, 7/5, July 5th, for the San Francisco Symphony at Sterngrove. A little lighter music on your way if you head up to Jack London State Park. Here's a sample.
When all the world is a hopeless jumble and the raindrops tumble all around, heaven opens a magic lane.
When all the clouds darken up the skyway, there's a rainbow highway to be found.
Continuing our rainbow theme for Pride weekend ahead, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, with a little-known verse being sung by real-life couple Megan McGinnis and Adam Halpin. To introduce you to this summer's Transcendence Theater Company productions at Jack London State Historic Park. Since its beginnings in 2011, Transcendence has played for over 36,000 patrons and raised $117,000 for the Jack London State Historic Park. Shows take place in the open-air 150-year-old winery ruins at the park. And I've got a couple of guests here that are going to talk about what's in store for people if they head that way. Stephen Stubbins has been on before here on KALW. He's performed on Broadway, on national tours of Mary Poppins, in opening acts for Frank Sinatra and Rita Moreno. And on any given weekend, he can probably be heard in wine country singing for some nonprofit cause or other. Stephen, welcome back to Open Air.
So glad to be here.
One of the stars that is going to be part of Transcendence Theater Company's 2015 is Meggie Cancellor. She's performed on Broadway in Wicked and Finian's Rainbow, as well as The Apple Tree. Lots more credits to your credit. Welcome to you.
Well, thanks.
Stephen, so what's in store for folks at Jack London this summer?
Well, we're excited because, like, every year, first of all, this is our fourth season that we're entering, so we're still very young up in that area. But the fact that we've been able to play that much of a difference in the life of the park, this park that was going to close 3.5 years ago, which is now thriving. The cool thing for us is that people, when they come to our Broadway Under the Stars performances, they can really get a full sample of a Sonoma County experience all in one night. You drive through the vineyards to get up there. You picnic next to the vineyards in this historic, beautiful location. We have local food trucks. We have seven or eight different Sonoma Valley wineries pouring, local musicians. And then, of course, under the stars in these majestic open-air winery ruins, you see the sun go down, and you have performers like Meggie Cantzler, who's with us. Throughout the summer, we have about 60 different performers who are coming up with us, so many people from Broadway and national tours, people that you've seen around the country. And each night is just a thrilling experience.
And for people that haven't been there, it's a certain that alone is enticing news to know that they'll be helping the park as well as hearing some great music.
Absolutely. Our company was kind of founded on outreach and service. And so the fact that we can that we left our Broadway careers to make more of a difference in the community, and that partnership with the park has been so meaningful to us, and how it really has been thriving since we've been there.
Meggie Cantzler, how'd you get involved with this goofy bunch?
I had heard about them in the New York Broadway community for years, and the way that they work, you don't necessarily audition for Transcendence. You apply, and it's referrals, because they want the right blend of people that believe in what the company stands for to come out and be a part of it. So I had applied. A friend of mine referred me that had been in the company for a while, and so I spent 2 weeks out here last summer and then basically never wanted to leave again. So I'm here all summer in all four concerts this year, and I'm excited. Our first one has just been off the charts. We didn't expect for people to be going as bananas as they are. But
yes.
Nice.
We had a performance yesterday at Wells Fargo, two shows, which I'll let Stephen tell you about. I loved the first show yesterday, the people that we got to impact that we wouldn't have gotten to do otherwise. And then we had a full performance at Wells Fargo, and that was the first time we had done the concert inside ever. So that was interesting.
And that's the Wells Fargo Center for the Arts up in Sonoma County near Santa Rosa.
Right, right.
Which is the big house there that a lot of the touring groups come through.
Mm-hmm. So is New York home for you then, Meggie? Where's home for you?
It has been since 2006, but I'm a born and raised Kansas City girl.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. It's true.
Corn fed. There you go.
Those Midwest values just really nailing it.
So what tunes will you be a part of in this show?
In this show, I get to do a little Whitney Houston. I do How Will I Know. We have a cool medley where two guys and three girls, we sing a whole bunch of different things in of her songs and blend it together in a very cool way. And then we all come on and do some dancing at the end of it, which is phenomenal. I also sing a musical theater song from Thoroughly Modern Millie, Gimme Gimme. So the thing that I love about these concerts is we do everything from pop music to, you know, oldies to classical to, you know, it's just kind of a blend of a whole bunch of different styles that you would never hear together, and yet they make sense, and it's wonderful.
And Stephen, there's some themed weekends that are coming up as well, something geared towards family. And of course, if it's family equals Disney, I think.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. We every year, our second Broadway Under the Stars concert of the summer, it usually happens in mid-July. This year, it's July 17th and 18th. It's our fantastical family night that we do. We do a kids camp that week, actually. And those kids campers perform one or two numbers. But just like our other Broadway Under the Stars shows, it has about 20 different Broadway performers in it. And it has Disney. It has all sorts of fun things that are geared towards families and kids. Last year, one of the big hits was we had eight women, eight Broadway divas singing Let It Go, this really unique original arrangement from, of course, everybody's favorite movie, Frozen. And that things like that. We had a camel in the show a couple years ago where we had somebody singing Arabian Nights with the camel coming up over the hill as everybody saw it. So it's a really special way of integrating, getting kids to really engage with this type of music.
And Meggie, you must enjoy the fact that this is in wine country.
I mean, I do. I'm a big wine enthusiast. That is true. So again, when I heard about this company, they said, oh, singing and dancing in wine country, I feel like, you know, it'll be right up your style. And I have to say that it just kind of exceeded all expectations when I became a part of what they do out here.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Stephen, anything else to share about the stars that you have lined up?
Yeah, well, I mean, in addition to each of our shows having about 20 to 24 performers in them, we're very excited that this summer on July 25th in Jack London State Park, we're bringing Megan Hilty, who's doing a one-night performance as a part of our Transcendence Artist Series. People would know Megan Hilty from the TV show Smash, where she played one of the Marilyn Monroes, vying for that part. And then also she's kind of a big name from Wicked. She's done Wicked a lot. So people can be excited about that. But people like Meggie Cantzler, who's with me today, are just stellar Broadway performers who have diverse talents, some incredible rhythmic tap dancers. We have a rhythmic tap dancer who's coming out this summer who is on So You Think You Can Dance. Mixed in with, we always have Stephanie Cadman who plays incredible fiddle and tap dances while she fiddles. Mixed with...
Exactly.
Incredible rock.
You never know what to expect.
Yeah, incredible rock performers like David R. Gordon, who sings our season theme song this year, who is on the Flashdance National Tour, singing Gloria on that. So it's a way of tasting so many different colors in one evening. And like our first concert's called Oh, What a Night, people just have incredible nights.
Well, you brought an original tune along with you on the CD. Tell us about the tune we're going to hear.
Yeah, so every year we have a season theme, and this year our season theme is Best Night Ever. And what we do is we create an original song, which you'll hear, Best Night Ever. But we also have an original wine that was blended with Benziger Family Winery. We have an original painting that was painted that is the wine label, but it's also a mural painting. And it is our season theme, so it's on all our T-shirts. So if you come up to Sonoma County or if you're in San Francisco and you see people wearing huge letters, big night, Best Night Ever on their T-shirts, you'll know it was with us, the Transcendence Theater Company.
More information at transcendencetheater.org. Meggie Kensler, I wish you some fun performances and your wonderful stay in wine country this year.
Thanks so much.
I'm sure we'll have you back. Stephen, as always, a pleasure to have
you
here.
Good to see you.
Music from Transcendence Theater Company, written for them, Best Night Ever. And then some book reviews or book suggestions with Peter Robson. Stay with us here on Open Air.
What's the point in feeling afraid when I've got so much left to say? Don't know if this heartbeat will sustain, but I'm gonna try it anyway. All of these voices collide, telling me it's time to take flight.
And all we gotta do is have a
live from the ruins, Best Night Ever, the 2015 season of the Transcendence Theater Company. Information at transcendencetheater.org.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write the preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot is just to tell them that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers as my book ends how to make two lovers a friend.
A perfect introduction to my guest and regular contributor, Peter Robinson, who's going to share some summer reading ideas for Land, Sea, and Air. Welcome back, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. Yeah, and it is summer. We've had the solstice. And here are some thoughts, because I think summertime invites what I call deck chair reading if you're going to the beach. If you're delayed at the airport, you certainly need to have a book in your hands. And if you're driving, I'm also a great advocate of audiobooks. I think books could be a great travelling companion. And the six recommendations I have for this week, which I think would certainly take you through the summer, are three non-fiction and three fiction. So I'm going to start with the non-fiction. And we may not remember it, but I did. It is now 45 years since the Watergate break-in. And so there are two outstanding books on Richard Milhouse Nixon, otherwise known as Tricky Dicky, and I would recommend both of them. The first is by Evan Thomas, the title being Nixon, A Man Divided. And I think that subtitle is a real clue to understanding Nixon. I think this is the best single-volume biography of the Nixonian presidency, his growing up, his boyhood, his becoming a politician, and then the years breaking into the Watergate and beyond. The book raises fascinating questions. It's certainly an insightful history about this very enigmatic politician who was as maudlin as he was Machiavellian. And in the recent years, certainly since 2007, those tapes that we haven't heard have now been released to historians. So both Evan Thomas and my second Nixon book, Tim Weiner's book called One Man Against the World, have had access to this material. And if you thought the initial revelations were bad, see what happened in the ensuing period. A couple of small points. People may not realize it, but Nixon was incredibly shy. And I remember interviewing David Frost after he did the famous interview, and he was constantly having to say to him, you have to look me in the eye. And of course, it was David Frost who finally did get that moment of truth that Nixon had recorded things and he did know what was going on. So the first book, Being Nixon, A Man Divided, Evan Thomas, and the second, One Man Against the World. This is subtitled The Tragedy of Richard Nixon by Tim Weiner. Tim Weiner is, of course, the person who wrote the history of the CIA, Legacy of Ashes, the FBI, so he knows this period particularly well. And maybe his is the more objective. Evan Thomas was working on the Washington Post when Nixon was in power, and of course the press was definitely high on his list. They were referred to as the Georgetown mob. So to some extent, Evan Thomas has a fight in this fight, and he wants to put the record straight. Two highly recommended books, each looking at that period with new revelations that have come about in the last couple of years. The next non-fiction book is called The Road to Character. It's by David Brooks, and people may know him from the News Hour. He and Mark Shields are the two commentators. This, I found, is probably one of my best books of the year so far. It looks, in the best sense, how to live a life, and it distinguishes between eulogy, what is said when we depart, and resume, what we put when we want to get a job. And he uses some really interesting examples about characters who've gone through major social changes in their life. He ranges from St. Augustine to Dwight Eisenhower and includes people like George Eliot, Samuel Johnson of the Dictionary fame. I think this is a really thoughtful book, which in many senses goes beyond trying to be a self-help book. It's a book that looks at how we live our lives. It looks at it through the eyes of a social scientist. At the same time, it tells just remarkable individual stories. Again, the book title, The Road to Character, the author, David Brooks. Now, if we move on to the realm of fiction, Kate Atkinson, the British author, has a new book out called A God in Ruins. And this covers, to some extent, a flashback technique between memories of the Second World War, where the main character, Ted, is a bomber, a pilot operating in World War II, and then it moves to the current time. And I think this is some of the best fictionalized descriptions of both wartime bombing, what it's like to be in those planes going over Germany, and at the same time flashing back to London, what it is to live through the Blitz. But the book moves forward to his marriage, to his grandchildren, and how war hangs a long shadow over our lives. There are things you remember, there are things you wish you didn't remember, and there are things, of course, which you can't forget. So this is Kate Atkinson, the book. Definitely a must-read for the summer, A God in Ruins. The other two non-fiction books, the first is called All the Light We Cannot See. It's by Anthony Dower. Again, this has got shades of World War II. It kicks off in Paris. The main character is a young blind girl. Her father works in the museum. He's actually a clockmaker. And he teaches her by illustrations and models how to get around Paris without being able to see. And then it all happens. The Germans invade. They move, this time to Brittany. And then the book flashes over to Germany, where a young German boy, same age as her, is a technical radio expert. And his job, eventually, is to tap into the resistance radio. So this is a book about radio, about how it was used during the wartime. It's also just a very dramatic story of two young people growing up under very difficult wartime conditions. A moving book, a touching book, and I think poetically and beautifully written, that moves from Paris to Brittany. And then my final interesting piece of fiction is called The Meursault Investigation. It's by Camel Dowd, and something we all read in school many years ago was L'Étranger, The Stranger, by Albert Camus. And this takes us back to contemporary Algeria, but it picks the story up about Meursault, and it picks the story up about the person who got killed and his family. So it's a kind of flashback technique of looking through Camus' eyes at what it means to live in colonial occupied Algeria and then Algeria today. It's a book about loneliness. It's a book about walking along beaches. It's also a book about a thoughtful reflection, this time by a contemporary journalist. It's his first novel, and I think is just an outstanding novel. So just to recap, in case you want to capture those titles, Being Nixon, A Man Divided by Evan Thomas, great insights on President Nixon. One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon by Tim Weiner. This is really based on his access to the current tapes, which have just been released, and he has had time to study them. And then a novel by the distinguished English author Kate Atkinson, A God in the Ruins. And in between, just that little bridge, David Brooks' Road to Character. And then two final non-fictions, All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dower, and finally The Meursault Investigation by Camel Dowd. I like that line in C.S. Lewis's book Shadowlands: we read to know we're not alone. And to me, a book can be a great companion. Sitting at the airport, waiting for that plane, it keeps you company. Driving long distance in a car, slip in the disc, and there you have an audio companion, another great travelling companion. Or simply, at the end of a day, curl up, entertain your imagination, open the page, and yes, you've got something great, a good read. Good to be here.
Thank you very much, Peter. We'll see you again down the calendar. Well, I'm going to conclude an odd way to conclude a program with an overture, the overture to Fidelio, which again is part of the San Francisco Symphony's concluding Beethoven Festival, concluding their 14-15 season. Thanks to Lizak Shallet for sitting in for a vacationing Niels Swinkels. And a reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. You can also send me suggestions for shows by sending me an email, david@kalw.org. Beethoven. 2004 recording of Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony, the Leonore Overture, actually the Fidelio Overture, the fourth overture that eventually ended up being the overture to the full opera of Fidelio. Three other versions of the overture were often used for concert reasons to this date, but that was part of the Fidelio Overture. Again, Fidelio rounding out the San Francisco Symphony's 2014-15 season. Information at sfsymphony.org. In addition to Nina Stemma singing the role of Leonore, performances tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday at Davies Symphony Hall include soprano Joelle Harvey, Brandon Jovanovich as Florestan, and Nicholas Fan as Giacchino, among others, and the San Francisco Symphony Chorus, Ragnar Bolin, director, all under the baton of Michael Tilson Thomas.